This is Season 3, Episode 11 of the Green Data Center Podcast. There's been a lot of things happening in the news around data centers lately, so we'll take a look at some of those main articles, but then we might also highlight some of the more obscure ones as well, especially those around sustainability. You can visit the website greendatacenterman.com to go ahead and submit any questions or subjects you'd like to hear about. Plus, if you have any questions or you have any disputes, if there's anything that you have heard and want to talk more about, please go ahead and submit there too, greendatacenterman.com. Also on the website, there are courses to get you kickstarted in your career on data centers with the Data Center Essentials 3 courses there on udemy.com. Also, the team is working on some new articles that we're going to be launching on the site as well, so keep your eye out for that. Also, please like and subscribe to hear more on the Green Data Center Podcast. All right, a lot has been happening in the news, so where do we start? Well, let's look at one of the deals that we had reviewed before, and that's the deal with Switch and what they were looking at with that acquisition by DigitalBridge and IFM Investors. Now, there's a little bit of drama here because there's a couple of the investors that are suing in order to get more information from Switch. Because right now, the way that the transaction was put together to the shareholders, the valuations weren't necessarily tied to what the original valuations were by Goldman Sachs, one of the companies that went ahead and assessed Switch to make sure that the value was there. Now, the thing is, let's not get alarmed. This is not a lot of drama here, okay? This is where there was a few things that seemed to be, omitted. But the details are where these deals are made. And sometimes when those details are missed or they're overlooked, whenever you're putting a deal together like this, it can lead people to get very alarmed very quickly. And one of the ways that you look to make sure that that's settled, that you protect yourself, is you go ahead and raise a lawsuit. It's common practice. So what we're looking at here is not really anything from Switch's bad business or anything like that. It's just they need a few things to be buttoned up and to go ahead and be more transparent with some of the materials, some of the information, according to what this complaint is looking for. And that's about it. Now, if you're an investor or you're involved in any of these companies, I'd say that there's really a very small risk that anything is going to be causing this deal to follow through. There hasn't been any update in a couple weeks now, but I would anticipate that this deal would still go through by the second half of 2022. So we might see it get delayed a little bit into, say, October, November, December. But overall, I would not expect this deal to sort of just break apart. On a more positive note, the Infrastructure Masons, imasons.org, they're looking for more nominees for their 2022 awards. Now, the award ceremony isn't going to be until November, December, but they are looking for all those nominees so that they can be evaluated. There's a lot of different categories and a lot of people to sift through to make sure that everyone is recognized that can be. And then where they sort of, who really stands out amongst them. Now, the 2022 award categories are the same as has been in the past. They have a sustainability champion, diversity and inclusion, education, and technology innovation champion. So there's 4 champion awards to be given, and they will have many nominees that go into each one. And I think that they will go with the top 3, 4, 5 for each, and then select one that maybe stands out a little bit more than the others for each one of those champion awards. Now, you don't necessarily have to apply one of your colleagues for those specific awards. You can also have the IM100 award, and that is given out to a lot of different people who are helping the industry in general, maybe not as much in one specific category like that, but they are definitely knowledgeable and deserve recognition. The last category is the Luminary Award, and that's like a Lifetime Achievement Award. But this is much more, because this award is given to those who are changing the industry and advancing it, whether that's coming up with new papers, metrics, to go ahead and lay out the future for what the data center might be. But it's also having that leadership of the teams or the individuals to go ahead and push the boundaries going forward with that reliability and sustainability. Now is the time to get those nominations in. So you can nominate yourself, a colleague, but now is the time to go ahead and do that. And it doesn't matter whether you have done a lot or a little, or if you have a big company name behind you or not. iMasons is about the fairness on what people are doing for their group, for the industry. So if you've done some things that maybe hasn't been highlighted in the industry, go ahead and bring that up. And this is a great place for the iMasons and the industry as a whole to go ahead and point that out so that you receive the recognition or at least acknowledgement of that participation and the efforts that have been done so far. Also in the news is a Wyoming project called Wyoming Hyperscale White Box, and it is to be a data center in Wyoming that's looking for a massive amount of heat reuse from the data center site. Now, this took a little bit of diving into to understand how they were doing things and arranging things. But overall, it looks like they're aiming for a hyperscale to have a high density of 80 kW per cabinet. Even higher is possible, up to 100 kW per cabinet. So that's what they're looking at, and doing that all with water cooling. So if you're looking at that 80 kW per rack or cabinet, then you can start to do that with that water cooling and going with their style of water cooling in order to achieve a better efficiency. That's one of the plays that they're looking at. Now, that waste heat from that liquid cooling is going to be just circulated through an indoor farm facility. And that means they can go ahead and produce products year-round in Utah and Wyoming. Now, if you've been to Wyoming or that part of Utah in the United States, you can understand that there's a lot of cold that happens throughout a given year. And it's not necessarily because of huge amounts of snow. It's a lot to do with the wind and what the temperatures are. So if you've walked around Wyoming in the winter, you can understand that you're really bundling up. Otherwise, your ears are going to get really quite chilled in a short amount of time. And again, it's not because there's snow that's building up. It's because of the wind. Overall, the facility, though, is about 120 megawatts at that full build out, with 30 megawatts critical IT load in 10 megawatt vaults. In other words, three vaults are available now. And that's what they're looking at. And with that high density of that 80 kW per rack average, or even higher than that, if you can do that, they are looking at about 13,000 square feet of space per vault. That is smaller. So they're really packing everything in there, and they're doing all of that with that water cooling. And that's basically the secret to having that less space, is that high density. And therefore, that leads to the efficiencies that they're getting. Now, on the mechanical cooling side, because they're doing everything water cooling, they don't have the major crack units, those computer room air conditioning units that might have the CFCs or HCFCs. In other words, those hydrofluorocarbons that, of course, are bad for the environment. And because you do not have those major crack units with those refrigerants, you don't have the compressors that go along with them either. So therefore, you are also benefiting not just on the sustainability front, but on the energy as well. On the power side, they are looking to use the nickel zinc batteries. And that is deemed a more sustainable resource because it can be recycled. Now, they're one of the first ones that's going to be using this. So we're going to be watching what this data center is doing with that the nickel zinc or zinc nickel, however you want to refer to it, as that backup energy storage. So on that power side, we are looking for something that's going to be very innovative like this, and we're going to watch to see how this does over time. Now, there's a lot of other sustainable aspects, but it's important to just say that this leads them to get a LEED Gold certification, and that's that Leadership in Environmental and Energy Design. And that means that they can go ahead and achieve gold. They're going to attract their clients, their customers that can go ahead and move into the data center and appreciate its LEED Gold status for sustainability. Now, there's a lot of the credits under LEED that they're not going to get. They're not going to get any of the transportation credits, or, you know, like a lot of the site credits just might not be possible for them because they aren't near an urban center. They are not even near a suburban. As a matter of fact, their nearest neighbors at least 3 miles away. So they had to achieve a bunch of other credits that are local to them. And that's what's been applied here in order to go ahead and achieve that LEED certification. Also, that's not the only certification they're looking at. They are looking at Uptime Tier 3 certification and getting that awarded. It's not done. It's not common in the United States to go ahead and have that Uptime certification. It is more international, in my experience, where a lot of companies will just say, okay, we need a certification that says, yes, we are doing everything that it is certifiable by some international body in order to make sure that it's on par and that they're doing everything that they need to. That's where Uptime comes in. And they're chasing this same thing in order to make sure that they can say, you know what, we are going ahead and saying we are going to provide this data center at Tier 3 and make sure that it's certified that way. Because this company, they are new and they're not a huge data center player, so they're looking to make an impact by making sure that they do everything correctly with all the guidance that they're getting from the industry experts that they have on their team. Pivoting back to the data center energy use, their PUE is around 1.08, and they've got credits for going ahead to have the heat reuse. This is where they provide that heat reuse, and they say to their tenants, we are selling the heat that you are producing, thereby we can get you an economic PUE that's less than one. In other words, it's not costing you as much. We can go ahead and save you money by going ahead and reselling that heat over to these warehouses. And that's where they're looking at that PUE of being less than one. So less than one PUE, let's revisit that real quickly. This is something where PUE is a nice simple metric, right? It's easy to use, and that's why it's caught on like wildfire and we can't seem to get rid of it. Everybody, I think, understands, everyone that dives into those numbers understands that that can be manipulated really easily. So if you're looking to gauge your PUE, you're gauging it mostly for your own use. You shouldn't be comparing with those elsewhere. But of course, inevitably, everyone does. So everyone will say, well, PUE 1.08, 1.1, whatever it is, that's okay, fine. We understand the simplistic use. But theoretically, you could go ahead and state a lot of things about PUE until you actually start using it. That's why I like PUE as a realistic number that you're using basically in-house, as opposed to really championing it to say that you're the best PUE in the world. Yeah, there's a lot of debate, of course, around that. All right, well, how in the world do you get a PUE less than one? You know, Green Grid has that explained that, hey, it goes from one to whatever it's going to be for the amount of energy that you're using. But the way that this site looks at it is they point to James Hamilton's post, I think, from over a decade ago that says, hey, you know, even though we have this data center, these different metrics that we're looking at, he proposes one called TPUE, and that's where you have that total power usage, and that total power usage effectiveness can get less than one if you're using a method to reuse the energy. And in this case, it is heat that they're reusing. They're taking that in the form of heat and they're reusing it to go ahead and power these greenhouses in order to go ahead and provide food. It's exactly what James Hamilton had in his post article from way back when, 2009-ish, where you can go ahead and use that heat to go ahead and have a warehouse in a place that is not necessarily going to be able to grow things year-round. And in this particular case, that works out for Wyoming. So that means, by definition, you can go ahead and use that energy twice, therefore using and getting a PUE of less than one. Now, if you're growing raspberries or strawberries or whatever you're doing in the dead of winter in Wyoming, great, that's fantastic. I love that energy reuse. But technically, on a PUE side, are we playing with the PUE numbers again? Yeah, really we are. And this is just a manipulation of PUE done in a different way. However, if we want to say that we can get below a PUE of one, that's great, that's fantastic, let's go ahead and do that, if for the sake of the data center industry and making sure that we can advance the amount of energy that we're reusing. Others in the industry will look at that and say, well, where, it depends where you're drawing that dotted line. That warehouse full of raspberries, strawberries, cucumbers, whatever, that doesn't count. It should not be considered part of the data center. Therefore, it should not be part of that PUE. But even if you are drawing the dotted line around just the data center itself, if you are sending the heat out and you're getting cooler water back in, even if you draw that line to say the warehouse is not really part of that, you are really achieving a benefit that is going to be helping your bottom line on that total energy use. Okay, so, we understand the TPUE. Okay, great. We can get less than one. Fantastic by definition. Very simplistic, though, just like PUE is. So let's go ahead and adopt that if we would like to. That's certainly fine. But everyone knows, I think, in the industry, let's just go ahead and reduce the energy overall. You don't need to define it with TPUE or PUE. You can go ahead and just say how much you're using and how much you're expecting to go ahead in that overall use. How much is actually doing compute, and then how much heat are you actually using, and how much savings can we get out of this with that dual use of that energy? Okay, that's the energy side. Now, one thing I don't want to miss, though, is another awesome thing that this data center will have. The Wyoming Hyperscale White Box team has looked at the water use. They are not going to be using water for cooling. Fantastic. On top of that, they are also coupling geothermal. And what I was trying to see is how big that geothermal was, what they're using it for, etc. Because geothermal and data center don't necessarily match up too well, just because geothermal acts like a big battery. If you have a lot of heat and you're sending all that heat into a geothermal well field, well, you're just heating up that field and it is going to require time to dissipate. And that's not really what a geothermal field does. You can go ahead and pull the energy back out. But for a data center, are we looking to pull heat back out? No, we're usually rejecting it all the time. So more to come on that. But the amount of water use reduction, that is just fantastic. So more to come on that, on the geothermal, as well as the overall performance once they start to load up the data center with actual customers. Okay, the U.S. Supreme Court has been making a lot of waves this year in 2022, but one of those has been on the EPA ruling rather recently. And even though it's been a few weeks, it really doesn't necessarily impact what was happening with a lot of the data center movement and what the environmental, social, and governance movement, the ESG movement, has been doing. Right now, everything has been voluntary for like a ESG report, and that will still continue to be voluntary. And it will be on each one of these corporations to make sure that it is accurate and correct and conveyed correctly, and that you're not misleading anything. Now, of course, that is the ESG as far as those reports, because it's being done by another party. Now, given the Supreme Court has said the EPA cannot regulate the emissions from power plants, the existing power plants. Okay, that's one aspect of that. But what it does mean is maybe those ESGs become a little bit more lax, less restrictive on what they're showing and how the companies are getting those ESGs. They might be able to just cherry pick the information that they want to show and not show the full report. We might see that coming. Now, is that reminiscent of websites where certain manufacturers and such go ahead and just show what they want to show and then tout they do all these claims and such, but whenever it comes down to it, their actual manufacturing processes might not be as good as they say. That's maybe where we're headed, but right now, all that accuracy and everything is not misleading, so we are on the up and up for this ESG, so right now we are trusting everything, and hopefully we'll be doing the same going forward. Talk about renewable energy credits, RECs, because that is the avenue for data centers to pretty much get themselves to go green and reduce their total carbon emissions. Now, the renewable energy credits, though, you have to go ahead and buy them from other people in order to get that clean power to offset the power that you're using locally. So while they install a solar farm or wind turbines, etc., at one location, you're not necessarily buying that direct power. You're buying that so that you can go ahead and take from the other grid that might be producing via a mix of different energy supports. So you might be buying partly coal, partly natural gas, etc. But that renewable energy credit, that offset, is helping you meet your sustainable goals. Now, a lot of people have a problem with still using all those fossil fuel powered electricity sources and then going ahead and saying that you're offsetting everything in order to meet your climate pledges by those renewable energy credits. Because ultimately, yes, there is still fossil fuel power electricity going to that data center. However, you are trying to encourage that renewable energy source. And by doing that, you're doing that to meet your targets, yes, as a company, but you're still reducing the overall amount of electricity, and that mix is getting better and better. It's aiming towards those renewables. Now, the other part to that is that these renewable energy credits can be cheaper for companies to go ahead and buy. They will go ahead and do this instead of trying to figure it out themselves. And it's the easy way of buying it your way out of it, which a lot of companies are looking to do. And ultimately, I don't have a problem with that as long as you're still encouraging that and you can offset all of your data center power that way. But what we need to start doing is looking beyond at that renewable energy credit and see what that real evaluation of it is. A lot of companies will not meet their targets, not get to where they want to achieve to, especially for data centers. It just ends up being strategically impossible for a lot of data centers to do that without these renewable energy credits. So let's go ahead and make sure that we can purchase into it. But those renewable energy credits are coming under fire for not necessarily being the best. And that's where sciencebasedtargets.org is a site that goes ahead and acts like a watchdog to make sure that it's going to be what it says it is and meets that energy performance of what was originally scanned out in their scope. Now, a lot of the company strategies out there are saying that they're not emitters anymore, that they do not emit any greenhouse gases or have any carbon emissions, that kind of thing, which is, technically still not true. They are just buying their way out to say that they can say that they're not. Yes, overall, that is what they're looking at. But whenever it comes down to it, yes, they are still doing emissions. So what we need to be careful about is how that's defined and how we're stating that, because the words that they're looking at need to be accurate in how that's shown. So even though a company can, wave their flags and say that they are not an emitter any longer, or in 2 years they might not be an emitter, or whatever that might be, the rules let you say that you're not an emitter, but you still might be quite the emitter and just offsetting that with all those renewable energy credits. So what we might see is a little bit of divergence with those companies that can say, yes, we truly are a zero emissions company. We're not emitting anything. We're not using renewable energy credits to offset what we're emitting. And that's one aspect that the companies that can do that, that would be great for them to do that. And that way it'll free up more of those renewable energy credits for data centers that really need them, especially in places that they're already built and operating and they're not looking to move, because that's going to have a huge carbon impact too. So let's go ahead and see if we can get that split to say where a company or all the facilities and everything under its operations can be entirely emissions free without renewable energy credits, and therefore hopefully have more renewable energy credits free up for the data centers as there more are coming online. Though we're anticipating more data centers to use that as their strategy to also say that they're a zero emitter, whether they are or not. So we're likely to see maybe a few renewable energy credits come under more scrutiny to make sure that they're operating the way that they are, etc. But that's just pointing out we're getting into the details of what the climate change and energy savings are and the carbon emissions. We're reaching that stage where we can look at that granularity and a little bit more focus. So we should probably anticipate that and prepare for that in the data center realm as well. In other news, you may have heard about the self-driving car company Cruise and how they had a server outage that led to about 60 vehicles basically stranded throughout San Francisco. And it just was a server outage that they have not explained about the redundancy system or anything like that, but they couldn't even locate the cars. So it really makes you wonder what kind of fallback system that they have and what kind of redundancy they might go ahead and start to put in. Now, the company has been testing a lot, and they're majority owned by GM, but it just looks like a single point of failure from the data center side. That's what we might think of it as, but it might be more along the software side, or that server couldn't be brought back up. We just don't know at this point. They haven't really shown what the problem was or what the issue was, but they did have to go and retrieve them. All these driverless cars, they had to go find them and then retrieve them off the streets. So that's what caused such a huge backup of the traffic, not internet traffic this time, but just vehicular traffic. Ideally, we won't see this happen too often. You'd think that this would be one of the first things that people would solve for. So we're probably not going to see that happen with other groups and other companies, and Cruise will probably figure this out pretty soon to make sure that it does not happen. Yet. let's talk about the chip shortage again. So recently there was an act by Congress that was passed. It's called the CHIPS Act. And this whole thing involves trying to stimulate all the resources and supply chains so that we can have more chip manufacturing within the United States or within other resilient supply chains so that we don't have chip shortages. And if you think about who's involved in that, some of the major actors are behind pushing that CHIPS Act bill through Congress. So in that way, it becomes very much bipartisan. And when that happens, things can get done. And they're all the big names that you might expect. Intel, NVIDIA, Texas Instruments, but it's also all of those server users that are in the data centers, of course, that are also behind this. They are pushing to make sure that they don't have to pay premiums to be first in line to get the latest chips that come out. Now, if you think about all those cars and everything like that, they're the ones that are also pushing to try to get chips for all their smart features on all their cars and vehicles out there, because they don't want to sell a car that's not fully functioning, or they, you know, if they do, then they have to put in all sorts of waivers and make people sign off on that. And that means that drives down vehicle buying. Not good. Ideally, this will alleviate some of the pressure from all that chip manufacturing. If we can have that production of semiconductors in the United States, then that can be one aspect, but it doesn't necessarily need to be in the United States again. It could just be anywhere to relieve that pressure and provide more chips onto the market as a whole. Now, you might think of those major companies as being major hubs of manufacturing. Well, they outsource all of that. In other words, they don't do the fabrication, so they're fabless. So that means that they're outsourcing it to places like Taiwan, and Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing is one of the big ones. So it passes through there, and that's what we're looking to alleviate with this CHIPS Act. Now, this CHIPS Act does, of course, it's United States legislature, so it only really affects the United States, but it's promoting things like the mega fabrication that Intel has in Ohio, for instance. So if they can go ahead and get some extra funding and such to go ahead and complete this and get that fabrication in the United States on its way, they're going to suddenly have a hub in the United States that probably is going to prioritize the United States for where those chips go. It's going to encourage a lot more fabrication in the United States, so we might see some of those bigger companies that do that in the United States look to go ahead and launch some fabrication companies around in different states where they can get good incentives and such. But it's not just them that's going to benefit. If you have a fabrication plant in the United States that can go ahead and have the materials and everything that can produce at a good cost, good price, in other words, being competitive, then those fabless companies are also going to turn to them as the major manufacturer. So that's what they're looking to incentivize as well with this CHIPS Act. Now, overall, you might say, well, okay, those are the benefits, but who are the losers on this? Overall, I'd say there really aren't any losers out of this. The chip manufacturing plants are just going to keep humming for the years to come, and it keeps growing at like a 5 to 10% rate, depending on which forecast you're looking at. So really, there aren't any global losers out of this at all. It's going to relieve some of that pressure, and you might think that that's going to sink some of those existing semiconductor and chip fab places, but they are probably not. The market keeps growing, so by the time these fabrication plants come online, it's going to keep ramping up and you're going to need more and more. On top of that, think about all the chip designs that are going to be changing. We've seen a lot change over the last 3, 4, 5 years, where instead of having a standardized chip, you're starting to see more and more specialized chips. And that's what we might see in, say, some of the servers, some of those different locations, or some of the devices or even vehicles, where they might have smaller chips that are handling smaller things. And those become, say, the majority of the chips used. And then you have some larger or more standardized older chips that could maybe handle some of those larger loads or those kinds of configurations. That's what you might see as that specialization, where you have different types of chips being installed in different locations or for specialty items. And of course, if you have these fab plants, you're probably going to have other research facilities that are going to be looking at what's possible with those chips as well. So we can anticipate, like we already have seen, better efficiencies on these chips as well as getting more power. So your cell phone is probably going to be yet even more powerful and be able to do more with it than ever before. Okay, that concludes Season 3, Episode 11 this time. A lot of news categories that we covered, so if you have any questions about that, please feel free to reach out. Again, the best way to do that is to go to greendatacenterman.com and check out the contact form. Also, please don't forget to like and subscribe. It lets us know that you like the content and that you'd like to hear the next episode. Of course, unsubscribe whenever you feel like it, but it lets us know to keep going with what we're doing. And if you don't want to give that direct input to us or have questions directly, that's one of the ways that you can go ahead and support us, even if you don't want to contribute via our Patreon site. And if you have any questions that you'd like to hear about, we'd love to hear them and bring them up as a topic for discussion on the podcast. It's those perspectives that can go ahead and let us know how to conceive, design, build, and operate the next data centers of the future. So we're looking forward to it.